Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's broadcast, host Melvin Merritt talks with Jordan Belcher, formerly incarcerated citizen, author, and publisher of urban literature at Felony Books. Then Jeff Humfeld talks with 22nd District Representative Brandon Ellington about his weekly planning meetings to work on actions with constituents to address the problems in his district. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast, and as always, the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here is Melvin and his guest.
Good morning. Welcome to a live edition of Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt. In the studio with me is Mr. Jordan Belcher. He is the founder of Felony Books. Jordan Belcher was born here in Kansas City, Missouri. He has established himself as an ardent urban fiction writer committed to penning gripping and unforgettable novels. His plan is to create new and innovative ways to reach his urban fiction audience. Mr. Belcher was nominated for the 2014 Male Author of the Year by AAMBC. However, in about 2003, he entered into prison for robbery. He did 8 years in prison. During that time, he studied human behavior and craft of writing. He has put out novels such as Trapon, Blacktop, Hustlers, Trapon 2, Troublesome, and Status 1, 2, and 3, and Selfish in 2014. I'd like to take this time and welcome Mr. Belcher to the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here on Jaws of Justice. And before we get into your books, and you got some dynamite books here, right here in the studio, but take us back before 2003, where you entered into the penitentiary.
Before 2003, and actually a little before 2002, I was living the fast life, you know. I had worked for a little bit, but you know, seeing the people around me, they kind of living a little bit better. So I'm like, this money ain't coming fast enough. So I kind of got me a little plan together, got together with some people, and we just, you know, we jumped into doing robberies, and that landed me in the county jail. The county jail is, of course, anybody that been there is, you know, it's like the Thunderdome. So that was a waking up experience, but that actually prepared me for prison, where I went in 2003.
So during that time, that your robbery, you didn't just get caught on the first
round. No.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it got kind of, and I hate to say it, got kind of fun. Uh-huh. And so that's all we did. We just, I say maybe once or twice a month, we do a robbery and spend the money just as fast as we get it. Then we do another one. It was just headed down the road it went. Where it went is where it was supposed to go.
Fast life, they used to call it. Yeah, you know. Yeah. And generally that's what happens, either death or prison, one of the two, you know. And it's I don't know whether it's the first one or the second one, but either one is going to get you there.
Yeah.
And so take us on up into the time that you did enter into prison. What was going on then?
Yeah, when I went into prison, well, actually, let me jump back to the county jail. That's when I first, because they let you order books.
Mm-hmm.
So a friend of mine named Fee, actually OG Fee, he let me read this book called True to the Game. And that was my first experience with African-American street fiction or urban fiction or street lit. Some people even call it hip hop fiction, but mm-hmm. that just blew me away. So that was kind of like the turning point for me. But I didn't really jump into it seriously until I went to prison in 2003. And you don't have nothing but time. So it was just like, let me try this. Let me see if I can put something together. So
and you and I had talked on the phone, and you mentioned that one of the sparks was reading the book of Donald Goins.
Oh, yeah. That was actually after I read Terry Wood's True to the Game and Sister Soldiers, The Coldest Winter Ever. And then I got turned on to Donald Goins. And that's when I was like, oh, okay, this goes back a little further than 99. Right. So you've been doing this since the 70s.
Yeah, so. we also talked about people like, and we're not trying to advocate, you know, fast life or anything.
No, but
the point of it is we talked about Fast Eddie and Fillmore Slim.
Yeah.
And these are people that I knew when I was growing up in the Bay Area of Oakland, California. And so had an opportunity to meet Frank Scott and Fast Eddie. And they were the one that took me to the Pimps Convention on San Pablo at the California Hotel, and that just blew my mind. Mm. And so I can understand where you was thinking, you know, what you was thinking at the time that you read Donald Goins and all of these fast living guys that was making a lot of money, but the wrong way.
Oh yeah.
And so, you know, and I got kind of caught up in it myself, you know, a little bit back then. So. But now you mentioned Donald. We mentioned Donald Goins, and we mentioned Fillmore Slim, and some of the other ones that sparked your conscience in terms of wanting to write after you were in prison.
Yeah.
And you picked up these books and seeing what you can do to put something together yourself.
Yeah.
What was it that you put together in terms of your writing?
The very first book I put together, I can't even remember the name of it, but it featured, I used real names, and it featured everybody I was incarcerated with. So I had everybody that all of my close friends and comrades were. One person might be a drug dealer, the other person might be a cop, you know, so, and they were all in this story. So, and it kind of was getting a lot of good feedback just in my little incarcerated community.
And I've noticed, and not cutting you off, I noticed that, you know, you mentioned that you actually use characters, real characters in your book. And one of the characters that you use, you had him to die off. And
a good friend of mine, everybody just couldn't live through the whole book. So. I killed him off, and he came up to me. I remember we was in a rec room, and he like, man, I read the book. Why did I die? You know, what did I do to you? Like, I really killed him in real life.
Right.
So
he took it personal.
Yeah, he was upset. So, you know, and I couldn't rewrite the book for him. But, from that point on, I stopped doing real people and real names. And I was like,
taking it personal.
So.
Especially the ones that was following your reading, your writing. I mean, and so, you know, so what else come out of this? You know, you talked about studying people and their characters and things like that, because we talked about their behavior, human behavior. What motivated you to watch that, and what caused you to really wanted to look at the human behaviors?
It was just intriguing to me. I got one story in particular where I was in 3D. This was actually the county jail, though. But, you know, I still think about that incident where it was just a little guy. He was like the smallest guy in the wing, but he had the loudest mouth, and but he would intimidate through the pitch of his voice, and, you know, couldn't fight a lick, come to find out. But he just, and that just amazed me how he avoided a lot of trouble by just the slick way he talked. But just small things like that, and just watching people in the hierarchy in prison and the respect, like in prison, being knowledgeable and intelligent is cool, you know. So just,
because that knowledge has power.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you knew that you had to equip yourself, especially after you got sparked in terms of writing. And so once that spark began to ignite, you began to experiment in writing and stuff like that. And so what was the first thing that you started writing?
The first thing I started, the first actual real book was called Blacktop Hustlers. And I kind of used a little bit of myself from the main character and experiences that I went through in my teen years. And I put that inside of a book. And that was actually, I knew you couldn't make money off your actual crime. So, and my crime was robbery. So I made this guy a drug dealer.
Mm.
So, and I told his story of him.
But it was a reflection of yourself.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Mm. So it was just a story of a young guy selling drugs and battling the street life with the love of his life. So,
yeah. You know, I was thinking while you were sitting, while you were talking about this, how you can take a negative and turn it into a positive. And this is something that I admire you, what you have done with your own life in terms of turning it around and turning it into a positive, even though it's using a lot of your own personal experiences and some of your interactions with other individuals that have walked down the same street that you have walked, and then you compiled it and put it in literature.
Yeah.
And so when I'm sitting here in the studio right now and with a couple of your books sitting on the table, which is, awesome. You know, I'm just blown away with the covers and the pictures on the books. And
thank you.
And it's just awesome. And I understand, I'm looking at it at the bottom down here, and it says best-selling author. And and it says Tony Steele. Now, is these are people that I noticed that you have started your own writing publishing company?
Yes, Felony Books. Uh-huh. Tony Steele was actually the first author that I signed. I was sent when I was putting out my first books on these different bookseller online platforms like Amazon and Barnes and Nobles, and it started getting a little bit of sales. I was like, man, I need to put out more books, and I can't write that fast. But Tony Steele is pretty prolific. I shoot him a letter like, hey, look, send me some books. I know you got, because we talked when I was incarcerated. We used to exchange books, and man sharpens man. We seeing okay, what you writing about? Oh, I'm writing about this. But so when I got out and I'm seeing how it's going, I'm like, hey, shoot me some books. So he shot me some. He shot me a big 100-something thousand word book. I said it's too big. We chopped it down into three, and the first one was a bestseller.
Mm.
So
and I'm seeing that, you know, because it says Jordan Belcher presents Street Mongols and Mafia Bosses 1, 2, and 3. So
yeah,
you have wrote at least have written several different ones from this, and it, as you mentioned, or at least yes, alluded to, that you chopped it down. Is that part of it?
Yeah. Street Moke. Well, this one is actually the one I put out. That the very first one was called Rico, and it was just one humongous books. But now it's Rico all the way up to Rico 4. Mm. But this one is Street Moguls and Mafia Bosses is actually his newest work. So online you'll see Street Moguls 1, 2, and 3, and this book that's right before you is just a hardback version of all 3 in 1.
Now see, when I picture a novel, you know, and fiction, and I'm thinking about maybe, you know, a few pages, you know, and a mm-hmm. small, but these books here, you know.
Yeah, these are actually not normal urban fiction books.
Yeah.
This is something a little different, because me myself, I love thick books, but a lot of the readers just want something real quick. But this is for these big trilogies, or for the real, you know, big book readers.
Now, how many authors that have fell under your umbrella, so to speak, since you started this felony company?
How many authors? I want to say I'm maybe about 15. I don't have an exact number,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, we like just this morning I had a young lady hit me on Instagram. She said she want to work with me. I gave her a critique of her work. So yeah, that number's gonna balloon.
Mm.
So yeah, we working with a lot of authors. So
but. So and how do they catch up with you, you know, if they wanted to, you know, if they inspired writers.
Yeah, on my website, felonybooks.com, and on my Instagram, at felonybooks, I always tell people to send me their first three chapters to felonybooks@gmail.com. And if we like that first three chapters, we'll request the full book. And if the full book is dope, then we'll make it happen.
So once you like that first three chapters, mm-hmm. and you tell them to go ahead on and finish it out or write it out, mm-hmm. what do? You encourage them by sending them a check, or how that works?
It's just a contractual agreement. We don't do advances, but we do a very competitive royalty rate, and we don't charge like some publishing companies. Like, they charge authors like, oh, for the cover it costs, you know, this amount, or mm-hmm. you know, but we don't do none of that. We handle all the production process. You just send us the book, and then we pay you every quarter.
I don't know whether or not I've asked you this already, but who was your first publisher before you got actually starting your own?
It was actually a guy, QB Wells, out of, I want to say, Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So he gave me a shot in 2009 while I was still incarcerated. Yeah, he published my book.
So you had a running start.
Yeah, and that's why I returned the favor to you know, people incarcerated. And a lot of people are under the impression that I only work with people that are locked up. But I got a few authors that. This young ladies, this just dope writers.
Yeah. So now, are you focusing on the? And you just mentioned that people think that you're only writing about the fast life and prison life and stuff like that. Are you focusing on other types of writing besides?
Yeah. We definitely venturing into other fields. Like for Halloween, we got something real cool, a nice anthology coming up where, you know. Yeah, of course it'll be in urban areas, and a lot of our books are from the African American experience. But mm-hmm. yeah, we might throw a werewolf or a zombie in there.
Oh,
so yeah, yeah. So yeah, we got that coming up.
So now, you know, when I'm thinking about writing, you know, now I'm thinking about a lot of time that one has to put into writing, and mm-hmm. maybe even. Putting yourself in seclusion, you know, getting yourself away from family and stuff like that in order to get your thinking and all the other stuff that goes along with putting some things down on paper. What is it that it takes for you to get this thing rolling like that?
Like what you just described, that's like the ideal writing experience, being mm-hmm. but you know, a lot of us don't have got kids and people yelling. You gotta just write it out. You just gotta find your time and write. Actually, when I was doing the 9-to-5 thing, this is actually when I first got out. You know, I would be in the work truck. You know, people smoking. Says it's cloudy and smoke. I'm still writing.
Yeah.
You know. So yeah, you just gotta write whenever you can. Right. Like right now, I'm fortunate to have a set time that I can write, but it didn't start off like that.
Remember, if you're just not tuning in, you're listening to Jones of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt, and in the studio with me is Mr. Jordan Belcher, and he is the founder of Felony Books, and what we're talking about is some of his literature or his novels that he has written, and he started off in the penitentiary writing, and he has now published there many novels and books and trilogies. And so this is who we're talking with, and so I pray that you continue to stay tuned to this show here. When we was talking about the writing and things like that, and you had a jump start out of prison, mm-hmm. and having your writing already start publishing with this company. So what motivated you to start your own company?
Before I even worked with QB out in Baltimore, I had already been studying self-publishing. Like, it's a book called The Complete Guide to Self-Publishing. If you're interested in self-publishing, that's a good place to start. They got like 9 editions, so they just keep updating it as the technology advances. But I always wanted to be a self-publisher, but to not be able to do it while you're incarcerated is frustrating. So it's, somebody gave me a shot while I was in there, so I took that. But at the end of the day, I always wanted to have my own company. Yeah.
And being a young man with which you have 3 children.
Yeah.
And we alluded to the fact that, you know, sometimes you have to put yourself in seclusion in terms of writing, and you said, yet in spite of that, you know, that's including with the noise and stuff.
So that's a dream.
You
gotta work through it. The seclusion and you know, I remember what movie was that? Oh man, The Secret Window with Stephen King.
Yeah, where
he went off into this log cabin and was writing, and you know, but yeah, nah, that's the ideal.
That's the ideal.
Right, yeah, but it's not real.
Yeah,
for most writers.
Yeah. And yeah, with 3 kids and raising 3 kids and making all that noise. And,
yeah.
And trying to, is there a separate place in your house that where you can go to and everybody is not to knock on the door?
Yeah. My kids, they kicked the door down.
Yeah. So now, is any other of the family members, and I know that we have a young lady in the studio that is your daughter. And is she inspired to write or?
Yeah, she has some stories in her head we've been talking about. She's like, lately she's been more focused on the film and the video side production. So
that's one of the reasons why she's inspired to be in the studio to take pictures of her dad.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so we want to definitely be a part of continue to plant that seed in our children. Mm-hmm. And so tell us about this one particular book that inspired you to write The Hush Love. What is that about?
That is actually about a guy that's, he was incarcerated, and while he was incarcerated, he wanted to change his life around. He's like, all right, this ain't the life where I want to go. And he had a fiance out there that was helping him out, and like, yeah, let's live a bet. We lived a good life while we was doing our crime. We paying our price now, but after it's over, let's do it right and build. And then she got murdered by somebody from his past, and that just, it just a book about how his mind shifted and he wanted revenge, and everything he had his mind set on, it kind of reversed. And when he was released with vengeance on his mind. So the Hush Love trilogy is about him avenging his fiance's death and then trying to find happiness through all the madness. So
tell me this before we make the announcements of your information, in case anyone is interested in trying to get in touch with you. Are you planning for some of these books to maybe hit the movies or?
Yeah, that's an every author's dream is to get to film. So I still got a lot of work to do. I've been at it for a minute, but I know I can. I don't think I've written my best book yet, so.
Okay. Now give us some information about how someone can get in touch with you in case they might have something to shoot to you.
Yeah, you can reach me at facebook.com/jordan.belcher2. You can reach me on Instagram. I'm on Instagram every day at Felony Books. My website is felonybooks.com, or you can even check out jordanbelcher.com.
And what about, is there a number they can reach you?
We ain't got the number yet. Okay. That's my person. Just hit the website. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Belcher, I'm so glad that you joined us here on Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1. Thank you for coming out.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Now, the calendar for July 10th. You are invited to join Amnesty KC on Thursday, July 13th, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Kansas City Center for Inclusion, 3911 Main, KCMO. Their guest speaker will be Samantha Ruggles, Operations Manager for the Kansas City Center for Inclusion. She will talk about her organization and what can be done to make certain that LGBTQI rights are protected and honored. Refreshments will be provided. Corey's Network and the Chuck E. Cheese at 18701 East 39th Street in Independence, Missouri, are once again teaming up to help victims of murder. On Friday, July 21st, from 3 to 9 p.m., 15% of all purchases at the register, including food, merchandise, and token deals, will go to a reward fund for anyone having information about who murdered two young boys, Montel Ross and Jaden Ugwa. You are invited to help out this cause and enjoy food, fun, and games. If you have information, call the TIPS hotline at 816-474-TIPS. That's 474-8477. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn, for sitting in for Beth Pike. And this is Jeff Humfeld, and we're back here now. And our guest in the second half of the show here is Missouri State Rep from the 22nd District, Brandon Ellington. Welcome, Brandon.
Now, how y'all doing today?
Well, not too bad. I'm going to let you carry this show, this so to say. Why don't you give us a little bit of what happened with this legislature and you know, the things that are coming out of it, because there's some pretty horrendous stuff here, the budget cuts, the special sessions and all this. Yeah. We're going to talk about that a little bit, but then yeah. We also want to talk about some things that you're doing this summer. So
yeah, I would actually like to steal a quote out of several religious texts to describe what happened at the legislature this year. It was doomsday, revelations, the end of the world, the whole nine. So basically, we passed a whole bunch of anti-work-related bills, right to work passed, paycheck deception passed, Senate Bill 43 passed, which is the anti-discrimination bill, which pretty much makes it impossible to sue for discrimination now because it changes from a contributing factor to a motivational factor. And for those that don't understand what that means, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you only got fired for one singular reason, not contributing reasons, meaning you're a woman, got hit on by your supervisor. You couldn't say you got fired because you wouldn't give in to your supervisor's come-ons. You would have to prove that was the only reason you got fired, which is almost impossible. Then we have several budget cuts that the governor is still doing, withholds. I won't go through each one of them line items. But we're talking about everything from home health care to children treatment services to youth services, withheld money to almost every, well, not almost, but every college in the state, health care cuts, blood service cuts. I'm trying to read through the list real quick. A lot of cuts, man. We did a lot of cuts. I think we're up to almost $300-something million in cuts right now from the budget that we actually passed. We're still getting updates. We won't have a finalized budget until around veto session. One of the major things that he vetoed that was Kansas City was looking forward to was a UMKC music theater. So he's still rolling out cuts right now. But it was all bad business this year, and that's not a partisan opinion. That's just the reality when we look at the amount of people that's going to be affected by the senior services cuts that we did, the tax credits that we cut. And the last thing that I would like to say, you have the treasurer coming out talking about the income tax credit that people would be able to receive back off of their income tax. But I want you to know that credit is not a benefit because we cut so much money, you're not getting anything back. It's more like a hand in the face while the other hand is in the pocket technique that's actually happening with that tax cut.
Okay, I want to go back to one of the bills that you talked about, which was Senate Bill 43, the discrimination Bill. And one of the things I think that I want to let people know is that the Missouri NAACP mm-hmm. has put forward a travel warning across the nation that, you know, if you're traveling through Missouri, you may want to avoid Missouri because they're because of this bill mm-hmm. Your rights will be curtailed.
Yeah.
My understanding is that they were kind of waiting to see what the governor did, whether he vetoed this or signed it or just let it go into effect without his signature. And I think that they may be considering, you know, putting forth an actual ban, mm-hmm. you know, recommendation from the NAACP. I don't know that for sure yet, but that was kind of what I understood. We've been trying to work it out to get you know, the head of the NAACP here in Missouri on to talk to us about this issue.
Yeah, now you need to get Rod in here.
I'm
not sure about the ban. They need to. Just to let you know how horrendous this is, or listeners to know how horrendous this bill is. Underneath the old law, it's easy for somebody that's been victimized at the place of employment to actually go back for discrimination by proving that it was contributed. So again, going back to the example with the young lady, and this is the example, one of the examples that I use on the floor. If I was a supervisor and I'm harassing a female employee that works for me, under old law, if I fired her and I was trying to get her to go out with me, et cetera, it's easily provable that that was a contributing factor, that I was sexually harassing her. She didn't give in to my advances, and then she ended up getting fired. When underneath this new law, she would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the only reason she got fired is because she wouldn't come on to my advances. And that's impossible. And that goes to age, religion, race, et cetera. So this law is something that a lot of civil rights organizations has came out against, but people should know that the Missouri Chamber of Commerce has came out in favor of, which is ironic, and people need to watch the way that they spend their dollars when our largest economic entity wants to lower the bar when it comes to discrimination in the state of Missouri. And they did it. The governor signed the bill during 4th of July weekend, which was clever because it got silenced because of the holidays and everybody was moving. I believe he actually put it out on Friday, late Friday.
All right. One other thing that we talked about before the broadcast here, which is the ID bill. And mm-hmm. we talked about two aspects of that. One is, of course, the voter ID. And then there's also the national ID requirements that you did finally pass, so that mm-hmm. that we can get an ID in the state of Missouri that will actually allow us to get on an airplane. So why don't you talk a little bit about those two, the voter ID.
Okay. I'm going to start with voter ID, and then I'll bring it up to the real ID. Voter ID is something that we passed last year, or the year before last year. It's coming into effect now. You have to have an ID to actually be able to vote now. Old law, you didn't have to have your identification. If you don't have your identification, you can sign an affidavit. The voter ID is something that was pushed by the Republicans, and it should disenfranchise up to 280,000 people. And that was the number of people that didn't have a current Missouri issued ID. The real ID is a little different. So the voter ID, you just have to have an identification with your picture on it to actually be able to vote in the state of Missouri now, and it is a requirement, or you will sign an affidavit saying you don't have your ID. The real ID is completely different. The real ID was an act that was passed up underneath President George Bush in 2005. It's a federal government initiative. The state of Missouri had until this year to actually pass ours, or in 2018 we'll be beyond the limit, and we'd have been fined and all type of stuff. We've been under waivers for the last 3 or 4 years in the state of Missouri, and that's why people that had a Missouri ID was allowed to get on airports, was allowed to go to military bases. I believe last year the law came into effect, or the time frame went out, where you actually had to get a real ID. So therefore, people in Missouri started being denied access to military bases, but they were still underneath the waiver for the airport, so they were still able to get on the airports. Well, now we passed it. We will have to be real. You will have to be real ID compliant to be able to utilize any federal facility or any federal entity, whether that's the airport, courthouse, anything that the feds own. You have to have a real ID compliant federal identification. And again, this is a federal law that creates that contains all source documents. Me personally, I had an issue with the collection and the retention of all source documents, and also the forcing of states to supersede their rights and to force their citizens to have a real ID compliant ID, which goes to all type of things that could happen when we talk about a universal federal identification and what's to come after the unified federal identification. And again, all source documents is associated with it. And for those that don't fully understand what source documents is, that would be any official documentation, marriage license, divorce decree, anything that you have to sign, get notarized, it would be updated on your real ID.
Okay.
Big brother.
Yes. Why don't we real quickly talk a little bit about the special sessions that have been called and what happened with those, and how much money we spent on those?
I don't have the exact dollar amount. I know we're getting close to $1 million. Don't have the exact dollar amount yet. I can get it for you. We're at 20,000, 24,000, something like that a week. We've been in special sessions since last month. We're still in special session currently. The legislative body, we will not be back up there until the 24th, I believe, 22nd, 24th. The Senate isn't in right now, but the special session is still going. Last week, when the Governor Greitens announced that he was signing Senate Bill 43, and also when he announced a lot of the cuts, he also announced that he was expanding the special session call. So we will be going back into a second and a half to the third special session in about a week. And what makes this so bad, during session, you have the chance to get legislation passed. At the state is completely controlled by the Republican Party in the House. It's 118, 119 of them. It only takes 82 votes to get something passed. In the Senate, it's 24 Republicans. It's more than 24. It takes 24 votes to get something passed in the Senate. They have almost 30 Republican senators over there. It's only 8 Democratic senators over there. So as far as being able to control legislation, to get legislation passed, they have the ability to do it during session. Special sessions should be meant for emergency style issues, things that we have to get done that we didn't have during the special session, and this is why we're forced to do it. It should not be for pet projects that the governor wants to do just to do it. And the special session that we've been called in for consideration has everything to do with abortion services in St. Louis City. So we've been called in for a special session for an ordinance that was in effect in St. Louis City. He expanded the call to ensure that the facility, the pregnancy prevention facility, was not allowed to get out of the decree. So we're going to expand the call for a special session for something that is not an emergency, for something that was already sanctioned in the city of St. Louis, but we're going to charge everybody in the state. The first special session was for allocation of jobs in the southwest part of Missouri, and that was January the 1st. It was a potential 500 jobs. He called us in for a special session to approve a company that nobody in the legislative body knew who the company was. Nobody knew their hiring practices. Nobody knew if they was actually going to come here. But we had a special session to approve language to allow a company that nobody knows to come here and benefit and increase the utility bills of everybody outside of Kansas City that falls up underneath Ameren Utilities. I had to get all of that out.
It's paying favors off is what it sounds like and what it looks like
across
the board. That's all there is to it. And that from a governor that ran on, I'm going to clean up the mess.
Could I throw one more thing in there?
Sure.
Just because you threw that out there, and I blame you, Jeff, for opening up the door. But he said he was going to clean up the mess. We was going to have ethics reforms and all this good stuff. So if you think anything he would have called during a special session, it would have been ethics reforms. The problem with ethics reforms is then we have to start talking about the new caveat that we created up underneath the law where we have dark money flowing through. So last year, it was a voter-approved amendment that dealt with campaign financing, changed the structure of the campaign finance. But most people didn't understand when they voted for that is that it wasn't going to cut off or cap the amount of dollars that a politician can receive. It changes the process. So a politician can only receive $2,500 per individual. But it also created a whole nother caveat of nonprofits, LLCs, etc. So what the governor has done is created a nonprofit that doesn't benefit him, but it benefits all of his issues. So what I mean by that, this year, when senators haven't been willing to do what he wants them to do, he puts money is put into this nonprofit, and then they immediately start attacking the senator, running ads, etc. So the nonprofit can do campaigns, issues, and all this other stuff, but it's not directly tied to his campaign. So it's legal, but it's really more.
But it's unethical.
Yeah.
Basically, it's unethical.
Yeah.
I want to move on to something different here now. You've started, since session's been over, you started weekly meetings at your office,
3836 Chestnut.
36 Chestnut.
Are you good? You close. You just walk across the street.
Yeah, just across the street. every Wednesday at noon. And, you know, these meetings are not about talking. These meetings are about action.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to talk a little bit about what kind of actions you want to see, why you think there's action that's needed, and also what kind of actions are being planned and carried out.
Yeah, so we started a No More Excuses Coalition, and pretty much we're trying to not identify, because we already know the problems. The problems have been in existence for over 40 years. So we're actually trying to create immediate, short-term, and long-term strategies to eradicate most of the problems that we see, whether they're social problems, economic problems, or institutional issues. So when we look at the network of low-income areas, you got black folks, you got white folks, you got Latinos, etc., in these same economically strapped areas. And then you have the same social elements as far as high crime, lack of investment, lack of viable educational centers, etc. So as a educated society, we have two choices. We can sit back and we can always talk about the excuses for why it's like that. Well, you know, such and such happened, or they wasn't provided education, or it's violence in that area, that's why nobody wants to invest. Well, that cycle is going to continue to permeate. Nobody's going to invest because it's going to continue to be violence in that area. No educational centers is going to be there because we've deemed it unworthy. So what we're doing is actually trying to address everything. So I'm gonna hit you with a couple of the events that we have going currently, and then kind of expand from there. So July 29th is Enough is Enough Violence Awareness Prevention Symposium. Not a candlelight visual, but an actual symposium. So we talk about violence and everything like that that happens in the inner city. In Kansas City, we're a little under 80 murders right now. We and I'm paraphrasing this or creating the stats myself, but I believe that we average about 3 or 4 murders a weekend, which is ridiculous. So again, we're doing a violence awareness prevention symposium, in which from my office, we've been reaching out to multiple agencies. We've also reached out to Truman Health Services, etc., to actually bring in the resources and the elements that will help to constitute violence prevention, whether that's mental health issues, whether that's some social issues, some services, etc. And again, at the symposium, we're going to have a network of information, and we'll be doing a series of these to actually address the violence that's happening in the areas and to create preventable solutions. Because hiring 1,000 police officers, putting them on the corner of, let's say, 39th and Prospect, would not stop the murders. It would just push the murders from 39th and Prospect to 36th in Brooklyn. August 17th, we're doing the Pause for Peace. August the 27th will be the 8th annual Unity in the Community. And that would be located on 27th in Woodland. Obviously, it's exactly what it says. It's a Unity in the Community style venue. We've been very successful in the past, haven't had any violence in the past, and we'd like to continue to grow it and partner with anybody that would like to partner with their services that they can actually provide. One of the other excuses that we hear in low income areas, and it's an excuse mixed with reality, is that people in the area can't get jobs because they have felonies on them, right? So what we're doing is working with the Department of Corrections, DOC, Probation and Parole, Kansas City Police Department, and I'm starting to reach out to a couple other agencies, FEC too, and I'm starting to reach out to a couple other agencies to put together a job fair in the middle of September that's targeting people that have felonies on them. So again, that's a short-term solution. Long-term solution is entrepreneurship, owning jobs, utilizing some of these buildings, et cetera. But a short-term solution is identifying companies that we know will hire people that have multiple felonies on them, and these are good-paying jobs. So it is no excuse. It's just putting in the work. One of the last events that we have planned currently is the domestic violence a violence awareness and healthcare forum, and that would be October the 21st. So when we talk about domestic violence, now we're talking about some of the inner issues that we've been having that people don't discuss. When we got men, women getting killed, family, babies getting killed, these are more domestic violence issues than they are gang related issues. Then we have a couple events that are dedicated towards parental involvement. I do not have the date for the camping trip yet. I'm still going back and forth with the Department of Natural Resources, but we're going to have a free camping trip where we take kids out of the inner city. And that will either be in the middle of August or the middle of September. I'm still going back and forth with them on the date right now with that. But those are some of the short-term events that we have. But again, the coalition is being created to actually address elements. So when we talk about the social contract that we have in low income areas, that's something that actually obviously has to be done by the people that live in that area, which is identifying culture and what resources we find important in that area. When we talk about some of the institutional or civic aspects, Scott Wagner, the mayor pro tem, he's came out to the meetings. He's committed to working with the coalition and identifying properties, identifying land usages, and whatever other resources city can have. And this is what we're trying to do. I think you had a question, Jeff.
Well, I wanted to ask where people, you know, you've got a long list of things there.
It's,
you
short.
Know, where would people go to find that list?
We're still creating external databases. Currently, right now, what I've been telling people is to go to my hit me at the house, which is brandon.ellington@house.mo, and we get you updated on the email updates, and you receive everything that we're doing. We also started a No More Excuses Facebook page, which is on social media, so you can actually go to the social media page and check it out. Elect Ellington, which is my personal website. You'll be able to go up on there and find the link to the flyers. And on all of my social media accounts, which I all source with Brandon Ellington, you can find it. But we're still creating a network where we'll be able to get this information out. So any small businesses or businesses that are out there that's listening that would like to get involved, please email me at brandon.ellington.gov, and we can utilize your facility to put flyers in there and to kind of network. And I know it's a lot of work. Theoretically, I know people will say it's impossible to actually change a social contract and get people to demonstrate self-determination. But I know it's a necessity. So when I look at Kansas City and I look at the 100-plus murders that we have every year, when I look at the amount of suffrage that people is in, whether that's from abandoned houses, misallocation of tax dollars, bad educational centers, or the void thereof, I know for a fact that we have to put in the work to get it, and it's all accessible. So when you look at the amount of buildings that we have here and the lack of natural investors, that's something that can be worked on. The same we talk about the lack of jobs, economic density, et cetera. These are things that we can populate with a lot of our buildings, couple them with state resources. And again, that's why it's a coalition where we're reaching out to everybody.
Okay.
So you made me get serious.
Yeah. And this coalition is about doing. It's
yes.
not about talking.
Yes.
You know, we know what the problems are and what needs to be addressed. You got a number of different committees
yes.
that are actually working on issues. Can you tell us a little bit about what those committees are?
Yes. And I'm going to have to try to remember. And if I forget one, please forgive me. I know we have a community outreach committee. We have a youth committee. Economic committee, and the economic committee looks for everything with economic density.
I'm trying to remember that board myself.
Yeah. I think we have events ones that help with events, and we're creating a communication ones. And we definitely need as much help as we can on the communication one, because that's what's going to make it viable, is us being able to cross-pollinate and to get resources and activities off of the ground. And those are the only ones I can remember right now.
Yeah, and so if somebody wants to be involved and by involved, actually doing something, actually being actively involved, how would they do that? What would they do?
Again, send me an email at brandon.ellington@house.mo.gov, or you can contact me at 751-573-31. I think I gave the number backwards. 571-573-3129. Yeah, I do that all the time.
Well, and I do have that number on the Jaws of Justice page on KKFI's website, so as well as KKFI.
I really need to start calling myself up there.
There you go. Yes. The meetings that you have every Wednesday, why don't you tell folks once again where and when they are, and you know what they would expect.
Okay, every Wednesday at 12 p.m., we meet at 3836 Chestnut. And some of the things to expect when you come in there, number one, expectation. We're not talking about any organization in a negative fashion. Number two, we're not talking about any complaints in any shape, form, or fashion that's not entertained. Number three, to work on immediate short-term solutions. And then a couple of those with long-term strategies. So what we do every week is we come in there. Again, we don't have to discuss the problems because we know the problems. We try to discuss and identify solutions to various issues that we know is happening in the city, and then we try to immediately work towards implementation of those issues. So again, if you come, expect to be working, expect to come with an attitude of productivity, and we encourage people to think things that is vital to the community. We also have, again, with that outreach, the outreach is identifying individual needs. So when we hit certain areas, we want to identify individual needs and make sure those are met. And what I mean by that, we know healthcare is an issue, so we don't have to talk about healthcare as an issue. But when we identify certain areas, we may find somebody that is in a wheelchair that doesn't have access. Well, that's something immediately that we want to implement. That's why we're working with Truman and a couple other facilities.
Well, I wish we could continue, but our time is up. But I do want to let people know, Brandon, the number for Brandon's office is 573-751-3129. That's 573-751-3129. And, you know, Wednesdays at noon at 3836 Chestnut is two blocks east of Prospect. You have to enter off of 39th Street because it is a one-way street. But anyway, Brandon, we want to thank you very much for spending some time with us this morning, and good luck.
No, thank you, and thank you for getting the number right, because I was completely wrong. I was backwards.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following is from last week's Cultural Baggage program.
Talking about the rise, if you will, of fentanyl, carfentanyl, the manufacturing of counterfeit pills, etc. Well, we have a gentleman who can maybe not give a counterpoint, but certainly give us a different point of view. He's the deputy director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. He just had an op-ed appear in the Santa Fe, New Mexican, quote, ample scientific evidence exists supporting the contention that cannabis mitigates opioid abuse, dependency, hospitalizations, and mortality. And with that, I want to welcome Mr. Paul Armentano. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Dean. Good to be here.
Well, Paul, fentanyl, carfentanil, that's a major problem. It is affecting our country, is it not?
Well, it's clear, and it's been clear for quite some time, that there has been a rise in the use of opioids in recent years, and therefore there's also been a concurrent rise in the abuse of opioids and those that are suffering from the adverse effects of opioid abuse. One of those, of course, being mortality. And now every year we are seeing somewhere around 19,000 inadvertent opioid overdose deaths. Regulators are largely sort of shaking their hands. They're trying to come up with answers or potential solutions. And one discussion that should be on the table and often isn't on the table is the reality that we see a reduction in opioid use, abuse, and mortality in those jurisdictions where medical cannabis is a legal option.
Through this prohibition and through the ease of getting smaller, more potent products, say fentanyl from China to the United States, it's just easier to just set up these counterfeit pills, the counterfeit powders, and people just don't know what they're buying, do they?
Well, as the black market often does, it leads to a more potent product, and it leads to a product that is provided by unlicensed regulators. So you're correct. The consumer does not know what they are getting, and there is a very strong likelihood that they may be getting a very strong, potent product, a stronger and more potent product than they were anticipating. And that's often what leads to inadvertent overdose, in addition to using these products with other controlled substances and suffering the adverse consequences of a synergistic effect.
Again, that was Paul Armentano of Normal. We'll have part two tomorrow. DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.
We hope that you have enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. This is Jeff Humfeld. And our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesdays, Alternative Radio on Wednesdays, a mix of national and local programming on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m. followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Dr. Mike's Morning Medicine Show, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio at 6 p.m.